I would only say that, you know, the nonfiction that I have written has always been an urgent intervention. And together, somehow, when I looked at it together, the urgency put together over 20 years creates a special kind of narrative, a special kind of history, you know, because even the nonfiction I see when I read it.
We have 5 seconds.
I'm always telling stories.
We're going to do part two and post it online at democracynow.org, and there we'll ask you about Kashmir as a nuclear flashpoint. Arundhati Roy, the great writer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Cable with the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Bail Trap features short films and speakers on bail fees in the United States. Money bail is one of the main causes of mass incarceration in the United States. Low-income Americans are sitting in jail for days, months, and even years simply because they cannot afford to pay high bail amounts. Films include Breaking Down, Deal with the Devil, How Much Is Your Freedom Worth, and more. Again, that's The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Wednesday, May 15th, 2019, marks the 71st anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homes and became what is now one of the largest and longest-lasting refugee populations on Earth. KBOO will be participating in an all-day broadcast, along with CKUT in Montreal, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and dozens of other radio stations in Palestine, Europe, South America, Canada, and the U.S., from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Wednesday, tune in for Radio Free Palestine. More information can be found on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Radio Free Palestine.
And you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio for all of Portland and the Portland region. Up next, Cecil and Celeste with more talk radio, and to continue your Monday morning PA programming.
Good morning. Hey, you are listening to KBOO FM, your community radio station, and this is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday. It is Monday all day long. Monday, we are broadcasting this day, the 13th of May. And we welcome you so much for joining us in our programming. I am so excited to be able to join you once more. And we have planning a great interview. All of us are workers. All of us are working. And we are trying to find ways in which we can make sense of all our work and our lives. Joining us today will be David Rainey, who is a professor emeritus at the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He's the author of numerous books, but more importantly for us today, he's also been a factory worker, a laborer, and community organizer, and an activist academic. You say, so why am I interested? One, because of the work he has done. Today we will look at a fascinating memoir that he has written, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From the Outside In and the Inside Out. In this memoir, Mr. Rainey writes about the lives of women and men who worked in the factories of Chicago's South Side in the 1970s and early 1980s. And what we discover in his volume, not only his stories, but the stories of workers in that very important period in American labor organizing history, and also an important part of American transition in terms of how we organize our society. David will speak this week at Ask Me headquarters on May 16th, 6025 East Burnside at 6 p.m. on May 16th. And joining us today is David Rainey, and we are pleased to have him as part of our circle this morning. Good morning, David. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, good morning. Before we start, is it Ranny or Rainey? Because I remember reading how one of the men that you work with used to tease you about it's raining.
Yes. No, the name is Ranny, people often get it confused. I'm not sure why, but there was a lot of confusion at the plant about that.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here and sharing your stories with us.
So maybe you can tell us briefly, for those who are just learning about you, in terms of your transition, in terms of from a pretty secure tenured professor, and what happened that caused you to move to transition from a professor to working with laborers.
Yes, well, I was, as you mentioned, a tenured faculty member at the University of Iowa. I was very active in the social movements at that time, the anti-war movement, the black civil rights movement, and the women's movement, and many other things. But the whole country and much of the world was in a period of real insurgency, and I wanted to be part of that and felt I was being constrained in Iowa City, so I took initially a year's leave of absence from my position, but eventually gave that up as well and came to South Chicago. It's on the southeast side of the metropolitan area where there was a heavy concentration of manufacturing, and worked at a free pro bono legal clinic called the Workers' Rights Center, but soon ran out of money and decided to support myself by working in factories.
And that was a particular era which is unfamiliar to where we are in terms of our society today, in terms of manufacturing, the essential role that manufacturing and jobs play in our economy at that time. Could you paint a portrait of our society, our economy, in the late 70s and 80s and where we are today?
Sure. That area of southeast Chicago was, I think, typical of industrial areas, except this was the largest such area in the world. If you can picture this, there were 1.5 million manufacturing jobs, all of which paid living wages, that was anchored by 10 steel mills and hundreds of factories like the ones I worked in, that were either supplying the steel mills, or using steel, or simply taking advantage of a very experienced labor force and infrastructure, including ports and rail transportation and truck traffic. And that concentration of industrial activity was eliminated, eliminated rather quickly, so that today that same area has only a fraction of the number of workers, and many, if not most, are not making living wages.
Not only that, the jobs disappeared, as you indicated in your book, but as you described the manufacturing and labor environment, can you also describe the social environment? I was struck by how diverse the population of the industrial areas were.
Yes, it was quite diverse. That particular area is the oldest Mexican community in Chicago area. A lot of Mexican workers went to Chicago to work in the steel mills and ended up living there. It also had a very high concentration of black workers. Again, many came from the South in different periods and began to work in the factories around there. And then there was a white ethnic, mainly Eastern European population there, and there was a church near the Workers' Rights Center that had masses in three languages, Polish, Spanish, and English. But those populations were largely segregated in terms of where they lived, and there was a very high degree of racism and antagonism among the groups. But they did mix and come together at the workplace, and also the kind of main commercial drag where there were bars and restaurants that were open 24 hours a day. And walking down that street, as I describe it in my book, you can see all of this diversity, despite the fact that they were living in different neighborhoods.
Fascinating, especially given the fact that you had what seems to be a contrary or contradictory, rather, relationship, in that while people were segregated, there were times when those walls were bridged by personal relationships or dependency upon each other in the work environment.
Yes, that's right. For instance, at the one factory that I spend most of the time on in the book, there's actually seven of them with different stories, but that one actually had three separate areas where people took their breaks at work. The one that seemed to be for whites was much superior in terms of its condition to the others, but they all took their breaks separately. And yet, when we had a struggle, which we did, a wildcat strike that lasted 3 months, that when we had that going, then the fact that all these groups had a common class position in society took precedence over the antagonisms, and they did indeed pull together, and I think actually enjoyed each other's company.
You're listening to More Talk Radio on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in Points East in the Columbia River Gorge. Along the Willamette River Valley, it's 104.3, and KBOO.FM on the web. We're speaking with David Ranney, who is the author of Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From the Outside In and the Inside Out. One more thing I wanted to touch on to help people get an idea of what it was like in the 70s and the manufacturing environment was some of the actual environmental issues. One of the things that I read repeatedly is how the air is smoke-filled, gritty, how it's foul-smelling at some places, how the environment is dangerous to the workers' health, and how that that general grittiness kind of it expands outward into the city and certain neighborhoods. Can you speak a little bit about the just health hazards of working in manufacturing?
Yes, well, it was very great. I describe a walk down Commercial Avenue, the kind of main drag of South Chicago, at that time, and there was kind of a fine red dust that covered all the cars. As you said, the air you could practically choke on it. And of course, when you got into the factory, it was worse, because that's where it was coming from, not only the one I worked in, but also the steel mills and many of the other factories. Then, you know, once inside, there were different hazards at different plants. We at Chicago Shortening, we used to put out wastewater, and it was pretty bad stuff, and it clogged up sewers. There were a lot of chemicals used in the plant, as well as that spilled out into the neighborhood. But those of us who worked there did take risks from a health point of view of what the factories were doing.
As you talk and write about the experiences, not only you but all the other workers, what we discover in this volume are the ways in which communities found their strength, they found their ability to work with one another and to confront issues of differences, whether it's of race or ethnicity, but also on ways in which people found ways in which they had to work together. Oftentimes when people think of labor organizing, I don't know oftentimes, but I think of labor organizing in the 50s and 60s, and clearly here in the 70s and 80s, are the divisions that continue to plague workers, often differences such as race continue to be emphasized not only among the workers but also by the owners of the manufacturing industries. Say something about the role of race and how different racial and ethnic groups related to one another.
Yeah, well, when it came to hiring people, there were certain jobs that really were reserved pretty much for white workers. The job I had at Chicago Shortening was one of those, of being a maintenance mechanic on the shop floor. I was given a special test, I didn't realize it at the time, that was really designed for someone who had at least a good high school education, if not more, and that really left out many of the other workers, both black and Latino. So that was definitely an issue when I came into the plant and continued to be confronted, just the assumptions that were made about people's ability based on race and based on ethnicity. There was also a very harsh period on immigration, that there was a clampdown on people without papers. The Immigration Service regularly raided the plants in the area, and they actually attempted to pull off a raid on our plant, which we were able to foil. But nonetheless, it was not unlike the present period, a very difficult time to be an immigrant.
On top of the fact that there were problems and divisions racially, I find it interesting that repeatedly there was a situation that you described where the people who were doing the hardest and most difficult and possibly dangerous jobs and labor were often those who were paid the least. And yes, I think that's a concept that may catch a lot of younger people by surprise.
Yeah, well, you know, this was really typified by the steel industry, which I was not working there, but I was involved in some activity around it. There was a practice that was sanctioned by both the union and the company of putting black workers, and I think many Latino workers, into the harshest, dirtiest jobs like the blast furnace, the pickling department, and so forth. And in the union contract, it specified that seniority, that is your ability to, the length of time you've been on the job, gave you an advantage in bidding on jobs when they opened up that paid more, but they had what they called division seniority rather than plant-wide seniority, meaning that a black worker working, say, in the blast furnace area could bid on higher-paying jobs only within that area. So that if a job as an electrician, for instance, opened up in the mill, they did not have seniority when it came to that. And that, you know, set off a lot of antagonism and a movement during that time as part of civil rights to do away with that practice and have plant-wide seniority. And the union and the companies, the mills, got together and, you know, they had to do that because the government said they did, but they offered as a settlement for all the losses of the past only a very small amount, something they called the consent decree, and there was, as part of the civil rights movement, a struggle against that. So those kinds of practices then were replicated on a smaller scale in the many of the factories where I worked as well.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Join us in conversation as we speak to David Ranney. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Unions were important, but as they are now, still kind of discouraged. There was a really important role that your workers' rights organization played in several of the factories that you worked in. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was in a number of unions during this seven-year period. Some were better than others. The one at Chicago Shortening was the worst. It was a local local union within a larger union that was not local in name only. It actually included 17 factories spread all over the city, and we had no access to the union whatsoever, and it turned out to be kind of a mob-controlled affair. And when we had the strike, it was really because the union and the company had colluded on a contract ratification vote, and the workers, some of them did what we would call today an exit poll after we voted on the contract, discovering that hardly anybody had voted for the contract, and yet the company and union both swore that it had passed. So that kind of corruption existed. It certainly, in my experience, it wasn't true certainly everywhere. I think the broader issue was that the unions then and now are very much constrained by U.S. labor law, which really was the product of a period in the 1950s when labor was really in an insurgency, was making tremendous gains in wages and working conditions, and the unions, some of them were quite radical, and essentially the unions were forced to get rid of anyone who was considered a quote-unquote red, which most of them did, and then to accept a contract-based system where you couldn't strike in between contracts. You know, it's very, very constraining. So if you do get a movement on among labor that really could win something and perhaps win a new society, labor law becomes a real constraint in that. You need unions, but in the U.S. particularly, they are not able to do what, you know, I think all that's needed to be done.
And certainly, as we look at the union movement in the United States, unfortunately, we can look back in the 1970s and as maybe the last push where there was a in terms of union organizing in a very meaningful way. And certainly you mentioned briefly here in terms of you working with left-wing organizing that took place on the factory. Tell us, is that something that was unique to the time? Are there similar things happening now in terms of organizing by left-wing groups in working places?
Well, I think there are some examples, but I do want to stress that I think a lot of what went on in the period of the 70s that my book is about, you know, really were generated by spontaneous activities mm-hmm. of workers who found common cause in grievances they had. That was definitely the case of Chicago shortening. I did not organize that strike in any way, even though I got blamed
yes,
for it, but I didn't.
You and Heinz.
And I think that is generally true. You know, when there are grievances, people can come together, you know, without being organized by some outside force. However, you know, it is important to begin to form independent both community and workplace organizations, and that's happening. I know my talk in Portland, you know, that's coming up on May 16th, is being sponsored in part by the Burgerville Workers Union, which is part of an old tradition of the International Workers of the World. There is a union with Burgerville that, you know, I think is an important development, and we will probably be talking about that, I hope, on the 16th with the workers themselves.
Yes, and that's an exciting movement here in terms of organizing workers who have not been organized, and it's an example, I think, of finding our voices and our strength and doing things maybe a little bit differently. So you will be speaking at the Ask Me office on 60th and East Burnside at 6 p.m. on May 16th, and want to encourage our listeners to come and hear your presentation and be a part of those conversations this Thursday, May 16th at 6 p.m.
And I'll give the phone number again for folks to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, as we speak with David Ranney, who is the author of Living and Dying on the Factory Floor. There was the spontaneous, I guess I'll call it combustion, of workers at the shortening plant that came together, but the idea of workers' rights seemed to be foreign to just about everyone, so that your organization that you had worked with, the Workers' Rights Organization, was a big help to a lot of people. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about how they interacted with the folks in some of the plants that you worked in.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lawyer named Kingsley Clark, a good friend of mine, who started this place, and it was just a walk-in. It said Workers' Rights Center over the door, and people could come in, and people did. And for instance, during this whole dispute in the steel mills, there were caucuses that were forming on the shop floor that were outside of the union. There was a black workers' caucus, and there was a women's caucus. and particularly the Black Workers Caucus would come in to the office if there was a legal question. Kingsley was on hand to give them that kind of advice, but a lot of times they just wanted to use our high technology in the office, which was a mimeograph machine, which maybe some of your listeners don't even know what that is, but
yeah.
it was top of the, you know, we were a place where we could crank out leaflets, and sometimes we'd distribute leaflets for them at the shop, mill gates. But, you know, I think one thing I want to stress about that is that neither Kingsley nor I, and we were both members of an organization called Sojourner Truth Organization, mm-hmm. we didn't really see our role of leading anything. We didn't...
More of information.
Particularly, you know, using the law as the lead thing. The law didn't really work very well for workers. But, you know, we were a resource, and people would come in and to use it. Another thing that happened that I describe in some detail in the book is I worked for a time, about a year and a half, at a place called Solo Cup that made paper
yes.
cups. And it was a family corporation, heatedly anti-union. And one day, a bunch of workers, Mexican workers, the largest population in the plant were Mexican, came in with union organizing buttons on, announcing that we were going to have campaign to have a union. And the company really came down hard on it. I actually was surprised by this and looked into the union, and it really was not a good union.
This was the one that was mafia run.
It was mafia run, yeah, actually, as it turned out. But I sort of took an arm's length approach to it and decided to try to be supportive of the workers, but didn't get really involved until the company decided, in order to avoid having a union, that they would just simply start firing Latino workers who would be apt to vote for the union, mm-hmm. which they did. They just, you know, I was sort of amazed because it was just overtly illegal. And then, so what we did is that another maintenance mechanic and I, he was Mexican, decided to try to find the workers that had been laid off. And we asked Kingsley and the Workers' Rights Center to file a grievance with the National Labor Relations Board to see if we could get them their jobs back. And so, you know, they did that from the Workers' Rights Center, and we had some meetings of the displaced workers, the ones that had been fired. And then, of course, almost there was a snitch somewhere
in the midst.
I got fired yeah. almost immediately. But mm-hmm. That was the kind of thing that, well, we didn't really lead things, but we did try to be supportive. And you know, I think the most important thing in this kind of work is to know how to listen to people. And I, you know, it's
yes.
not a matter of a leftist going into a plant and telling everybody what to do. It's a matter of trying to understand the situation that people face and encourage their best instincts, and then help pull things together. And that was an example of that kind of activity.
Well, you provided a lot of information to people about what their basic rights were, but also there were a couple of occasions where Kingsley attempted to serve as your legal counsel while the union said, well, you're not really representing them because we are the actual union. And so there were a couple of times in the book that I noted that the better counsel was coming from Kingsley, but the unions thwarted it.
Yeah, well, that was certainly true in Chicago Shortening because, you know, the union and the company were really in collusion on this. And, you know, and so, you know, one example was that we got an injunction placed against us in the strike, and Kingsley and another one of the lawyers named Val Klink, the two of them filed a suit against both the union and the company in federal court, and the effect of it was to get the injunction temporarily lifted, and we were able to return to picketing. And then at one point in this, during the strike, the whole thing went to binding arbitration. There's a provision in U.S. labor law that a dispute can be adjudicated by a quote-unquote neutral arbitrator. The one we had was far from neutral. And when we walked into the arbitration room, the Chicago shortening workers had Kingsley and Val with us. Already in there was a lawyer for the union and two union business agents, and there was a lawyer for the company with the president of the company and some of the management. And the union lawyer got up and said, I want to object having Kingsley and Val in this hearing. They have no standing. We, the union, represents the workers, to which another worker jumped up and shouted, he doesn't represent us. That's what this whole strike is about. But nonetheless, the arbitrator threw Kingsley and Val out, and the arbitration, of course, was just a total farce.
You're listening to More Talk Radio, phone number 503-231-8187. And we're speaking with Dave Ranney, and we have a caller online. Bob, good morning.
Well, good morning, and thanks for this. I heard about the book last week and knew I needed to read it, and here we are.
Excellent.
Thank you. I also worked in the factories in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I had about 20, 25 years in. I was one of those angry white kids that got recruited in the factories, and that was my higher education. I really couldn't get into the spontaneity of the time, but I learned a lot. And my question is this. You know, there was this brief moment in the 70s when I think us white and black kids, youth, started to really get together. And it felt like we had some real cultural dimensions to that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the first time, I think, for me to get out of my neighborhood and meet other people and socialize. And I could feel that at work, and that's what helped move our wildcats where I was. We had, like, this very brief moment, and then the window closed, and the mm-hmm. reaction to that was pretty terrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm
yes.
wondering if you saw that as well. And if you,
oh, yes, definitely. And when you said that was your higher education, when you said that period was your higher education, I already had so-called higher education, but it was mine as well. I think I learned more during that period. I was only did it for 7 years, but in those 7 years, I probably learned more than I ever learned anywhere else about how the world works. And I definitely saw that. If you've seen the book, it describes a number of instances where workers came together in a kind of spontaneous fashion and worked out a way to combat the kinds of things they were facing. And our hope was that that would spread, you know, all over and help bring about a new society. That's what excited me about that time. And I think, unfortunately, that what happened was that the whole capitalist system was in a crisis during that period of time, and the people that owned the means of production were busily working out essentially a strategy to reorganize the system to make it work for them. And they achieved that by technological advancements that would enable them to produce bits and pieces of things in other parts of the world, so that when the factories left, it set off a chain reaction that undid a lot of the gains of workers' struggles of the past.
I guess what I'm asking is something like less global, but I take your point. I was in skilled trades, and you know, we had things like disco, right? We had bars that opened up to people of color and white working class people and like myself. And just this brief moment. I think it was about a year and a half, two, 3 years maybe at the max. And it was like a culture that, you know, in some ways I think it grew out of the 60s. I'm still thinking about this a lot. Mm-hmm. But I think it also had kind of an independent aspect to it. And it, when it showed up at work, we could organize with that. We could work with that really well and get over a lot of the division and fight the boss. And we always won. I mean, I never had one of those strikes. I never had a strike or a job action that lost. I mean, you know. So I'm asking you, did you have cultural forms in your work? Were you responding to something cultural?
There was some cultural coming together that you describe. I don't think in Chicago it was as great. That was sort of part of this struggle, is that those divisions, you know, during our Wildcat strike, which we didn't win, we lost it, but during that, I did certainly see that, you know, like we had a fundraising party at a bar in the neighborhood where all the groups came together. And, you know, we had music, we had a Puerto Rican folk singer come in and explain the Puerto Rican independence movement and sing songs in Spanish and English that, you know, black workers, a few white workers that were there, and the Latinos, you know, all appreciated and enjoyed, and that did strengthen us a great deal. But Chicago is still, you know, one of the more segregated cities in the U.S., and the racism was, you know, very, very deep, and so we weren't able to overcome it except in a few, you know, flash moments. We had a ways to go, and then once the base of manufacturing went away, I think that broke down a great deal.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for your response. I'm going to read the book. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much, Bob. And
well,
if
thank you for calling.
And if you
thank
have
you
the,
for calling.
And if you have the opportunity, join David on May 16th at the Ask Me Union Hall at 6 p.m. on 60th and East Burnside. We're speaking this morning with David Ranney, author of Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From the Outside In and the Inside Out. And as you, David, were speaking with Bob, it occurred to me if it would be possible for you to reflect on not only how economy has changed in terms of the role of manufacturing, but, you know, we hear so much from certain politicians about we're going to bring back middle class manufacturing jobs.
Yes.
And that's just not going to happen because the way the global marketplace has changed. But can you reflect on some of the changes that you've seen from then to now?
Yeah, well, actually, I say in the book that this notion of bringing back middle-class jobs makes me mad, you know, more because the politicians that use that term have no idea what they're talking about in terms of what these jobs were, not only what they could be, but what they were. And I agree that we're not, you know, that the capitalist system is now organized in such a way that bringing these jobs back on any scale is impossible, but also that we don't really want to return to what the kind of work that I was doing and that people in that area of the country were doing at that time. We would like to make living wages, though, right? And actually, because of the work that had been done by labor in the past, that we had pretty decent wages and working conditions. I mean, my wage in today's dollars would have been about $23 an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here now we're fighting for 15. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's rather sad because $15 even isn't really a living wage.
But, no, it isn't.
You know, we had living wages, but I don't think that the president and the other politicians that say middle class jobs mean that. What they mean is bringing back the sort of dirty, smelly, dangerous jobs that we had back then. And I think the real measure of whether something is middle class or not has to do with the control we have over the conditions of work, or whether jobs that pay wages like what I got are going to still exist. And that control does not lie with the working class. It doesn't even lie with the middle class, but it's the elites, the 1%, that really decide those things. And then managers and professionals, who I would consider perhaps the middle class in that sense, carry out their will, of the 1%'s will, that's what professional and managing occupations do. So what we found in the 1970s is that we had the rug pulled out from under us when all those jobs left, and that was orchestrated by the people at the top.
Yes. One issue, too, is that although many of those jobs were farmed out to other countries in this global economic market, many of those are not even the same, because they've become automated, and with AI, artificial intelligence, burgeoning, and not on the horizon, but really here, even more of those manufacturing-type jobs will be lost. And so what do you see as, I guess, an analog to the kind of labor market that we had, where people could produce goods that were durable goods and decent jobs, but paid a good wage? Is there anything coming our way, I guess I should say?
Well, I don't think in a capitalist system, no. I mean, I don't. That really, the capacity that capital now has, you know, not only to move jobs other places, but as you say, to replace workers with automated robots and artificial intelligence and so forth, you know, probably not. But the other side of that is that has put the system today into a crisis. It's every bit as deep as the crisis was in the late 60s and 70s that caused them to do all these things and eliminate jobs, because capitalism, in order to work, needs human labor to make useful things and get exploited in doing so, and that the other end of that exploitation is what allows capital to function. But also, if you look even at the liberal end of what economists are calling for, it's a system that depends on economic growth, and that in this country means a growth in consumption. And
yes,
this is putting tremendous pressure on the environment, and so we're, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost in that regard as well. So, but, you know, I think artificial intelligence and things like that open up some opportunities for those of us who want a better world, to be able to free people up to do other kinds of things, and, you know, not, you know, do away with the notion of wage labor.
Wow.
You know, and
that was a conversation stopper.
Yeah.
Well, it made my mind go off on a lot of different tangents, one of which was I was reading in the news this morning that China has slapped a higher tariff on our goods that we're sending to them, and we send them a lot of the goods that used to be made here in the United States, you know, like automobile parts, plane parts, train parts, like at one of the companies you worked at. And that's one of the places where they have automation, I mean, where they have a giant workforce, but are still bringing in automation to streamline it. And I'm just thinking, we're hearing how capitalism is pretty much running the show, but running itself also into a ditch. And I'm thinking with these high tariffs on unfinished steel that are used maybe in Mexico or Brazil to make auto parts, or maybe they're shipped to places in Indiana where they might be building refrigerator parts or whatever. It's still such a scaled down version of what we used to have that you're right, manufacturing jobs are just never going to come back. Not like we had them.
Not like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, but you know, they're also the president in doing what he did, slapping tariffs, and then the Chinese retaliating and so forth by slapping on tariffs. They're digging their own grave a little quicker than they would otherwise. So it seems pretty stupid thing on their part to do, but you know what the heck.
Well, they've not been known for long-sightedness. I mean, short-sighted actions seem to be the case. I think the only thing that's long-sighted out of the capitalistic economic system has been the fact that they were able to globalize. And that writing was on the wall a long time ago. We just, as workers, didn't have any control over it.
Yeah, but I think that's a really important point you make, because here I was on the shop floor, trained in economics, and I didn't really see what was coming, nor did anybody. And maybe if we did, we might have decided to resist plant closings more than we did. We might have attempted to, take the initiative and aggressively take over more production. Some of that happened, but not nearly on the scale that was needed. If we had been able to foresee this and even understand that in the 60s and the 70s, when there was all of this wonderful social activism going on, that the other side was really planning for literally a sort of holocaust of eliminating jobs and people's livelihood. And I see, I think that may be happening today, that we're looking around at what goes on, but are there not, I think it's quite chaotic right now, but are they not involved in planning something new? We really need to be looking at that and trying to figure out what it is so we know how to combat it.
And how do we do that? And what are signs of organizing, of thinking, that begins to confront what's around the corner?
Well, I think that we as human beings and the planet has certain needs, and they are being articulated to some degree, which the system really is incapable of meeting, you know, just basic things like food and clothing and housing and health care and education, those things that we need to simply insist as people and organize around that the system provide those things, even though it can't. And I think that will then open up the way. So a lot of the activism that's going on is very important, that you have in Portland. It's very important to continue with that, but then at the same time we recognize in a period such as this that there's a lot of fear on the part of many that they'll be at the bottom of a heap that's getting pretty thin, right, and that they are going to react, and this is what I think the president's base represents. But
yes,
you know,
and the push against immigration, especially.
Yes, and immigration, right? That's an important part of it. But then, you know, the kind of wannabe fascists. They're not. It's not a fascist movement at this time. But there certainly are a lot of hate groups, and they need to be confronted. But not only confronted, but we need, on the left, to offer a very different vision to ordinary people who are frightened and who are perilously close to become the kind of unnecessary people that aren't even needed by society. So we have a lot of work to do there. But I think some of these groups, hate groups, need to be confronted too. That's important work.
Now that's... Go ahead.
I just wanted to... You mentioned in terms of the rise of fascism, and I wanted you to make connections about what's happening within the United States and other parts of the world in terms of the rise of this type of political fascism.
Yeah, well, you know, I think when you have a large number of people who aren't really needed by society, then the to keep order, in this country, the historical relationship of race and class becomes sort of front and center, and also a nationality, so that the groups that have been historically fighting to get out of the bottom become they attempt to isolate them. Mm-hmm. But it also has to be seen as a class issue if we're ever going to get out of it, that it isn't just your identity and your particular kind of oppression as a black or as a woman or as a Latino, but also the class basis. But there's a lot of people, many of whom are most of them are white, who are just a tick above that. Black people were particularly isolated and many put into prison and others confined in specific communities with a heavy police presence. The white people don't want to be in that position, and so that's, I think, the basis for these hate movements to say that we're better than them, you know. And when those folks marched in Charlottesville and said Jews will not replace us, and also to black people, you will not replace us, that's what that was all about. And it becomes then the basis for them organizing. You know, we have to organize on the basis of class to combat that, and say the problem isn't that one white people are better than black people or men are better than women or anything else, that the problem is that we're all being exploited and, you know, you're being played, and really be able to make that case. And I think to do that, you have to be with people on a regular basis. And, you know, I think that's one, to use the Burgerville example, I think that's one of the things that's good about that, because these are the jobs, the marginal jobs that many people are forced to have. And if some of us are there with them, then we can really listen to their fears and try to respond in some way.
And provide information. So I see that as a great opportunity for a modern workers' rights center. It's like showing people what the rights are and how we can all get along. I thank you so much, David, for your book, your work, and spreading the new gospel of employment.
And we want to encourage people to come out and hear your presentation this Thursday at the 60th in East Burnside at the AFSCME Union Hall at 6 p.m.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. You've been listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste, here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour at 10 o'clock, Locus Focus. 11, it's an encore between the covers. 11:30, it's With Good Reason. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app, click on Donate, or just come in at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio. Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers. A talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie's sunglasses. If there's not his sunglasses.